Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'll leave you alone forever now.
You know this one girl with hair like this?
Yes, that's Ramona Flowers.
She's out of your league.
You know her? Tell me now.
She just moved here, got a job at Amazon.
I have to order something really cool.
Scott, are you waiting for the package you just ordered?
Maybe.
Scott Pilgrim?
Hi, I was thinking about asking you out, but then I realized how stupid that would be.
That's okay. You just need to sign for this, all right?
So do you want to go out sometime?
I say yes, will you sign for your damn package?
So, yeah, 8 o'clock? Come to this Battle of the Bands thing.
You have a band.
Yeah, we're terrible.
1, 2, 3, 4! Mr. Pilgrim! I'm Ramona's first evil ex-boyfriend.
What?
Welcome to Rewatchability. It is the podcast where we rewatch old movies and see how they hold up in a modern eye. I'm Robert LaRonde. With me, as always, is...
J.M. McNabb.
And today we have a very special guest returning. His name is...
Hi, I'm Graham Isidore.
And you are a writer and friend of the podcast. You've been on a couple times now.
Yeah, it's been... I think this is number three. This might be number four, but it's at least number three.
I think it's number three. And you write for Vice and a bunch of other places, right?
Yeah, I'm a contributing editor at Vice. I'm a senior writer at CBC Arts, contributing writer at GQ, all sorts of different places.
And we have a very special movie. And I think we say that and we don't mean it, but this is actually a special movie to a lot of people and a lot of people that we know because it was filmed right here in Toronto. It may even feature some people that we know. But before we get into that, first of all, we want to thank our Patreons. Those are the people who give us a little bit of money, some coins, and that helps us keep the podcast going, gives us a one-up every week. And in return, we give you a few perks, the podcast early. Sometimes there's some bonus levels, bonus content. Like a few weeks ago, we had the Indiana Jones commentary watch-along. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, and so if you want to become a Patreon, if you want to contribute to Rewatchability monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/rewatchability and do that there. So the movie that we're talking about is Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is a big movie, and this is the 10th anniversary of that film. And it's a big movie in particular for Toronto because it was not only filmed here, like a lot of movies, but it's actually set in Toronto and really, you know, uses the lifeblood of the city in everything. I mean, it's a film which the city becomes a character, to use that old cliche. One thing, though, is like the city has changed a bunch in the last 10 years. And Graham, you wrote an article for Vice a while ago about how much Toronto has changed recently. And it used a picture of Scott Pilgrim for the cover photo.
Yeah, it did. That was the idea of my social editor, Jill, who is very smart and wanted to kind of honor Honest Ed's, RIP. That was a giant department store, I guess, for lack of a better term, that used to be here.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
It was a thrifty miscellaneous store.
Yeah. It had been kind of like if all the things that you would sort of look for at like a Dollarama or dollar store nowadays were kind of combined with like a Sears or a Target kind of store and then designed
Just like outsized and gaudy.
Yeah, and designed by a person kind of in the 1970s, I believe, who was also like a theater mogul in the city and like owned a bunch of real estate. So it was sort of this like mad jack of all trades had put together like this mismatch of a department store. So yeah, the picture on it is of Honest Ed's in the background, and they're sitting in an iconic pizza in Toronto, which is a shitty Canadian pizza brand. And yeah, they're just kind of in front of that. Honest Ed's is actually featured really heavily in the comic books too. There's some scenes that kind of happened in there, but didn't.
Oh man, I wrote like a similar article just about Scott Pilgrim and locations changing, because as we'll get into, like a lot of it was shot in my neighborhood, and it was like the most innocuous thing, I thought. Like I basically went for a walk and took some pictures, and I was like, hey, the Goodwill is now a gym. That's weird. And then all the comments were like, you fucking hipster. Like what the fuck? I was like, whoa. It prompted such like vitriol. I was so surprised.
Yeah. I mean, to use like old cliches again, like, I titled the thing Toronto, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down. Of course, a reference to the LCD Sound System song, New York, I Love You, But You're Bringing Me Down. And then kind of this was my take on the whole like Joan Didion like leaving New York essay that's become so overplayed in recent years. But it's strange as you kind of get older. There's this author I really love called Natasha Stagg who said that like we all have our bars to mourn, which I really loved as a thing of like how the cities have changed and how that's all kind of gone down. But yeah, it's like it's interesting with Scott Pilgrim and looking back to kind of bring it back to the film. It's like this is very much a love letter to a Toronto that was, and it was interesting revisiting that time.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, just in terms of the city, like it's gone through like big transformational changes since then. It really does seem to like capture like the last gasp of something before Toronto has started changing. And now, I mean, it's gotten even worse with the pandemic. Like so much of the stuff that we know and love, it seems to be disappearing, and it's probably not going to come back, not in the same form that it used to be. So, I mean, I sort of went into this movie almost expecting like a eulogy to Toronto. I guess maybe just being cooped up for the last 4 months has gotten me a little bit cynical. But but when was the first time, Jam, that you saw this movie, Scott Pilgrim versus the World?
I saw it in the theater. I think I saw it the week after it opened. Like I was away, I think, the opening weekend. Because I was pretty excited about it because I was a fan of the comics. I'd read all the comics.
Oh, yeah?
And was pretty excited to see the movie. And, I like Edgar Wright. And even like I'd heard like the opening weekend was financially disappointing for the studio.
Mm-hmm.
I think they'd put a lot of money into advertising it. And even though it's a pretty quirky movie, they were expecting it to do something. And I'd read that it hadn't done that. But even knowing that going into the movie, I was expecting, you know, in Toronto where where it's, you know, which is so pivotal to the movie, that there would be like, you know, at least a sort of Scott Pilgrim faction turning out to the theater. But even just a week into the release, I remember, you know, it was probably less than half full on a Saturday night. So that was kind of weird. But yeah, I always I really liked it. But oddly, it's not a movie I've returned to a lot over the years. Like I certainly didn't have a problem with it in the time. And I have a lot of nostalgic associations with it, which I'm sure we all do, which we'll get into. Like they were shooting the movie the summer I got married. So I remember like people, friends literally were late to my wedding because they were shooting Scott Pilgrim. So it's always been kind of like tied up in like the nostalgia and like the, like you said, the kind of portrait of a Toronto that doesn't necessarily exist anymore. So yeah, I was kind of coming into this fresh. I don't remember when the last time I actually watched it in full was.
Graham, and we didn't know this when we asked you to be on the podcast, but you revealed it on Twitter. You were actually in this movie. You were a background actor.
Yeah, I was a background extra for 2 weeks on it. I didn't make IMDb or anything, so I think even if you guys were like
2 weeks, that's pretty significant, though.
2 weeks, and I was getting paid $18 an hour, which felt like an absolute fortune at the time. It was definitely the most I had been paid for any job I had done at that period. I was a part of like the scene with the DJ twins that was happening. I was in the pit for
that. That was the scene that my friends were late to my wedding because they were shooting.
That took forever. Yeah. It was like, and we were just like going on. It was the first time I had ever been on set for anything aside from like MTV commercial for MTV2 that I did, where I looked really frustrated at a grandma eating an ice cream.
You're so hip.
I know. I was just like, listen, there was a whole nother life that could have happened via 2009 me. And somehow I ended up here. I'm sure that person would be very disappointed at like both my hairline and my job that happened. But the bigger thing for that, I got asked to do a line in the film. There's a part where Scott is coming into the Chaos Theater, Gideon's Chaos Theater, towards the end of the film. And there's two groups of gentlemen who ask for a password. And I was going to be the floppy-haired one. And there's there's a gentleman who looks like... A lot like I looked like at that time period, to the point where it's like we were wearing the same choker and shit. So it was it was very, very sad. But I
so what happened? Did you biff the audition or what?
No, I fucking nailed the audition, but I had to I can seem apathetic and ask for a password very easily. I think that's still in my repertoire of acting. But no, I in a very Toronto 2009 move, I was moving to Montreal for the summer, and it conflicted with the date that I had to be at a French language program.
Wow.
That was happening. So shout out to the Explore program. It still exists. If any of you are Canadian students, you can spend 2 months in Montreal learning French for free, and they'll pay for your food and accommodation and classes.
Can you speak French?
Not a lick of it.
You gave up your movie star dreams.
I know, to go live in Montreal for 2 months. But yeah, I had sent in, everybody else was supposed to send in headshots when you were doing your extra stuff. I sent in my MySpace profile photo, which was a mirror selfie where I'm both like sucking in my gut and flexing at the same time in a very kind of contorted pose. And my bangs look perfect and my jawline is immaculate. So I was very sad not to be in that movie, especially rewatching it on Friday.
Wow. Were you critical of the other guy's performance?
I was committed. I was just like, you know what? He seemed like he cared a little bit too much. He needed to really like bring up his apathy, like at least a point or two. But yeah, it was funny. I was sitting with my girlfriend and we just sat and she was like, can you do the line for me? And I was just like, password. She's like, you would have nailed that. You would have done it really well.
We should look up who that guy is and like what his trajectory was after this to see what your alternate life could have been.
Yeah, it'd be so much better.
Like maybe that guy died of a heroin overdose a few years later and you know, maybe you averted something.
Man. I mean, there's so many famous people in that film and I was just like, I could have been among, you know, the Brie Larsons and is Chris Evans or is it Chris
Evans.
Pine?
Who
is
Evans?
Chris Evans. Yeah.
Yeah.
I too have trouble with the Chris's, but I'm pretty sure this one is Evans.
Yeah. He's very good. I'm not trying to be too cool to remember. I like Chris Evans a lot. I just, I have trouble with the handsome Chris men who have been in superhero movies.
I think I have a handle on him and Hemsworth, and then it gets foggy because there's Pine. There's, Pratt, and those are both P names, so it gets a little confusing.
Yeah, but he's very likable in that. Like even playing like the douchebag pseudo Jason Lee character in the leather jacket, I find him very likable in it.
Oh, he's great. Winnebago, yeah,
the Winnebago line makes me laugh still.
Yeah, it's a good performance. But so you were in the movie. You spent 2 weeks there. You almost were a credited cast member. Mm-hmm. What did you see the movie? I mean. Or yeah. Could you not look at it?
Yeah, it came out about a year later, the 2010 release date. So it was 2009, and I went back and looked at some old journals and stuff to kind of see if I had written anything about this time period as prep for this podcast.
Nice.
But yeah, I was really excited about it. And I think it was very interesting because I feel like in many ways that like the film being like a little love letter to Toronto and kind of how it came together, I feel like part of that was the fact that they really captured a lot of those extras and were like just, you know, people hanging out in the music scene at that time period. Like it was a lot of people that I knew who had bands that lasted for 2 weeks or, you know, were like waiters at DIY spaces or had just like just around skateboarding. So it was kind of interesting because I think it feels like that was just on the tail end of like the success that like Broken Social Scene had. And of course, like Metric mm-hmm. has a song that's in the movie and like, there's actually a Broken Social Scene song that's used really briefly in there too. It's so much of that time period just feels really, really well captured by the movie. But then also the fact that so many people, one of the reasons that is because so many people from like the music scene were just around, like, in that movie.
Yeah. I also saw this movie in the theater. You know, I'd seen Hot Fuzz at that point. I think I'd probably seen Shaun of the Dead as well. And so I was, you know, I was pretty ready for this to be like a fun movie. And I remember also liking it. I probably fall short of loving it, though I do love all the Toronto stuff. And just in terms of like what it meant for Toronto and for the city of Toronto and for Canadian filmmaking, sort of, I was really interested in all of that, because like the whole thing about Toronto is that it's a city where it is constantly cast as New York or Philadelphia or Chicago. You know, it's adventures and babysitting. It's the Incredible Hulk. It never gets to be Toronto. And I really loved, you know, movies I felt represented me, and most of them were by like small indie Canadian filmmakers. And this was a movie that finally sort of elevated it. I mean, it seemed like elevating to like the Hollywood space, and sort of, you know, brought the attention of the world on to people kind of like me. So I was really excited for the movie. I hadn't read the comics, so I didn't have that sort of connection to it, but it did sort of capture all the things that I really loved about Toronto, even before I moved here for university, like things like Lee's Palace, the Lee's Palace mural. Those were iconic from seeing them on Much Music when they would have the listings of the bands that I wanted to see, but couldn't see because I lived 8 hours away. So, yeah, I was, you know, super excited for this movie, or like super stoked, I think, to see it. I think, you know, maybe I projected too much into it, like, because it is sort of like referencing, you know, a place that I lived. It did feel like very much like, you know, my life in a way. Like, I know people who lived in small basement apartments in cramped situations, two to a bed. You know, I went to the Pizza, bought things at Honest Ed's. I don't know if it quite like lived up to it in that way. It did still feel like an imitation, or maybe like, you know, that's part of it being an homage, but like I said, I was a little bit worried that it would be a bit of a eulogy to Toronto, because so much of it has changed. And, I mean, we'll talk about how I sort of feel about it as we go through, which I guess we should do.
Yeah.
So
I will say, part of this rewatch, one thing that I really wanted to get to the bottom of, and I think that I'm not even totally decided, and maybe this conversation will help, is like how much of it is that I genuinely like this movie, and how much of it is that it represents the city I live in a way that no other movie does. Mm-hmm. And also like things that are very specific to me. Like, I don't want to give out too much information, but like this takes place in my neighborhood, like the comics even more so, like, and they, you know, they use the artwork for the comics that actually, you know, drew real locations in the neighborhood. And then the movie wanted to be as accurate as possible, so they went and filmed. So they filmed, you know, like literally one of the main locations is a stone's throw away from my house. So it feels so like embedded in my personal experience. And also I was in a lot of bands at the time. So I'm going to try to separate that from like my analysis of, is this a good movie? And I don't even know if that can be done. But
yeah,
I just wanted to say that from the outset.
Yeah, I think I'll echo some of those sentiments, like both Casa Loma and the park that they kind of return to a bunch of times are about like, it's less than a 10-minute walk from where I live now. And I've always kind of lived in the annex area of Toronto. That's like my home. So it was like a documentation that feels very, very close to home. So there's all sorts of random biases that are kind of coming into this right now.
Oh, we'll have to talk off mic about where you live, because now I'm curious, because you might be close to me. Because I wrote that article about some of the locations, I just walked around and took some pictures, and I went to where Scott's apartment is, and I felt like so conspicuous doing it and like a tourist, but it's literally two doors down from, where my son had music lessons, which was in someone's house. So I've spent lots of time outside that apartment, but I felt like an awkward fan just walking by to take the snapshot the other day.
Yeah, wow. It's like Ossington and DuPont area, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Somewhere around there
Yeah. Okay, well, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, it sort of starts with a chiptune version of the Universal theme, and that sort of like tells us where we are. This is a universe where there's a lot of video gamey things happening. You know, video gamey sounds. There's the Zelda dreamscape music that sort of opens it up. And there's a voice that tells us that this takes place long ago in the mysterious land of Toronto, Canada, which we just talked about. And then it says that Scott Pilgrim was dating a high schooler. And this is where I paused the movie because I was flabbergasted, I think. First of all, I had all these like fuzzy memories. I was in this good place. I was like, I want to see this movie about my home. And then the second line is like problematic as shit.
James Franco is texting a high schooler.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do we talk about that?
Well, the character is, how old is the character? 22?
Yeah, 22 to 17 in the movie.
I mean,
yeah. It's a weird, awkward place. And it's sort of in the film, all of his friends are, you know, instantly sort of against this idea of him dating a 7-year-old, but it's hard to tell whether or
17.
Not there.
17.
Sorry.
What did I say?
You said 7-year-old. So, sorry. I really didn't want to interrupt, but it would be my take on this movie would be very, very different if 22 to 17 is not the greatest, but 22 to 7 is not a movie I would talk about.
I mean, to be fair, like Manhattan is considered by many to be a classic film, and that begins the same way, but with like a guy who's like 45.
Well, yeah, for sure. I mean, Woody Allen's entire filmography aside, but his friends, like, they sort of, like, they're against it, but they're sort of more against it not because it's problematic or because Scott Pilgrim might be predatory. It sort of seems like he's just sort of, like, lame.
Right.
I think one of the central things about this movie and how much has kind of changed for me over the past decade is, like, okay, your question is, like, is Scott Pilgrim a good guy? Is he a hero? Is he portrayed in that way? Kind of throughout the film. And that becomes an interesting thing. I think it was very fascinating to me that like one of the last rewatchabilities that I did was with High Fidelity. And I think it's a similar kind of situation where I was like, at the time when I first saw it, I was kind of, Scott seemed relatable in the same way that the protagonist of High Fidelity had seemed kind of relatable. And now kind of looking at either of those guys, I'm like, oh, I'm not sure you're supposed to like this dude. And that's an interesting question throughout. And so I was trying to figure out in terms of like Edgar Wright's perception on it, like there is some, I think, some commentary towards the end and there are his friends kind of bagging on him the entire time, but are like, is Scott likable? Are you supposed to relate to him? Like he's definitely the protagonist of the film, but like that becomes a bigger question to me. Like, is it a documentation of like a schlub in his like early 20s who doesn't know what he's doing with his life and should get his ass together? Or is it like one of these things where it's just like, hooray for the humorous, you know, man child. Mm-hmm.
For sure. But so he is dating this high schooler. Her name is Knives Chow. His friends, they're not totally hip with the idea, but they're not like actively telling him to break up with her. Except Wallace, his roommate, does tell him to break up with her. Kieran Culkin is the moral voice. But he is, you know, he's a typical Toronto slacker guy. He's between jobs, he says. He plays in a band. He lives in a basement apartment that he shares with his roommate Wallace. It's one room. They share the same bed and they make gay jokes about it. But Wallace seems okay with it. So, and it's just like the typical Toronto slacker life until he sort of sees this woman in a dream. It's this purple haired woman on rollerblades, and she sort of just like blades through his dream, and then he spots her at the library. So it seems like this is, you know, the universe is trying to tell him something. And later on, he goes to a party and he finds out that she's going to be at the party, and he finds out that her name is Ramona Flowers, and he is instantly in love with her. He speaks to her at the party, but he bombs it. He uses the same line that he gives his 17-year-old girlfriend, the Pac-Man line.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing.
Hey, you know Pac-Man?
I know of him.
Well, Pac-Man was originally called Puck-Man. They changed it because not because Pac-Man looks like a hockey puck. Paku means flap your mouth. And they were worried people would scratch out the P, turn it into an F. like.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Am I dreaming? I'll leave you alone forever now. Thanks.
But he doesn't tell it very well the second time, and so Ramona's not interested in him. So it seems like, you know, his crush is for nothing, except that he finds out that she works for Amazon.ca. That was very particular in this movie. I enjoyed that. That is the Canadian Amazon. And so he makes an order on Amazon.ca and sort of waits for her to sort of show up at his door.
Which is funny because, like, it's very telling that this movie was made 10 years ago because her working for Amazon was, like, a cool job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, further evidence of, like, the degradation of corporate America.
So, I mean, she does sort of show up at his door, just sort of magically. He dreams about it, and he sort of coerces her into going on a date or hanging out, he says. He refuses to sign the package, and they do, like, a nice sort of winter Toronto date.
Wait, okay, I'm going to pause right there, because that was another kind of creepy scene, I thought. Which was
the coercing the person into a date.
Yeah, it was basically like imagine if she worked at like a coffee shop. Like that's basically like if he went into the coffee shop and like refused to leave until she agreed to go on a date with him. Like
it's exactly like that.
Yeah. It's I don't know. It's just there was a big chunk at the beginning of this movie where I was not on Scott's side and wondered why she was even kind of going along with this. But I guess it's Michael Cera's charming? I don't know. Is he charming?
I think the consensus is no.
It's just been like funny to kind of see just how things much have changed in terms of like what dynamics between like men and women are at that time too. Like I think we just have a better understanding now, you know, fingers crossed. But yeah, just like that kind of like the coercion into a date and then also like it was a question. It was like, why does he like her? Like, she's very beautiful for sure. And like, I mean, Lord knows I've been infatuated with many people with strange color hair over my lifetime. But like, it's yeah. It was just like they don't know anything about each other. You know what I mean? So it's just like this kind of like really. It's all just very seems very very superficial to kind of jump into it. But I also kind of like. It's, I wonder if I'm forgiving of that, because that seems like a long time ago now, but also cause it's like, I sort of feel, that's also kind of how I acted in my early 20s, you know?
Like, yeah. So I think like, I mean, I think this will come out through our conversation about the movie, but like, it's the, yeah, it's like the high fidelity thing. It's like how much of this movie is about a guy who acts like a jerk and then how much is the movie ultimately, you know, critiquing that versus like reveling in it for its humor, or like, are they trying to make Scott Pilgrim seem like a cool, funny guy, or are they kind of taking him to task a little bit? Or like, I mean, cause obviously Edgar Wright was not in his early 20s when he made this movie. So like, presumably, you know, there was a certain amount, nor was the, you know, the writer and illustrator of the comic, Brian Lee O'Malley, like there's a certain amount of self-reflection going into all of this.
For sure.
So, but I feel like that comes, I feel it less in the movie than the comic, but we'll talk about that maybe more at the end.
Mm-hmm. So they are hanging out sort of, you know, not officially, but his band, Sex Bob-omb, they play the Battle of the Bands, and that's where he brings Ramona, but also Knives shows up. And so he's in a sort of sticky situation because, you know, it's the whole double date thing. You got to do like the Robin Williams, Mrs. Doubtfire or something. But he just sort of like, you know, runs off and does the... does the performance. This sort of like becomes like the main conflict of the first act of the movie anyway, is that he won't break up with Knives because, as he says, it's hard.
You know, we were talking about this movie being kind of a eulogy for the Toronto that doesn't exist. I think like the Rocket wasn't even there when the comic was written. Like that was gone, I'm pretty sure. So I feel like that those kind of wheels were already in motion. Am I wrong, Graham? Do you know?
Yeah, the Rocket closed in 2005. I had to look that up because I was trying to figure out the different venues that were used in the film. So yeah, the Rocket was gone in 2005. It was a punk club that was around Church and Wellesley in the queer neighborhood. But yeah, it had closed before I moved to Toronto, so I wasn't familiar with the Rocket.
Yeah, they recreated it for the film, and they recreated a whole bunch of things. Like, even though it's still there, they recreated the inside of Lee's Palace for the fight scene.
There's also it was before the renovation, so the bar at Lee's is still in the middle of the pit. There's still a bar that's kind of down there, and that's
right.
Interesting to see kind of now the bars at the back for Lee's. But yeah, it was. They had to do that to be able to get some of the stunt work that was going in. They didn't have high enough ceilings, at least, to be able to facilitate the first boyfriend fight.
I mean, yeah, this is where he gets confronted by Matthew Patel, who is Ramona's first boyfriend. And he had sent an email, but Scott Pilgrim found it boring, so he didn't read the whole thing. And he sort of attacks during the performance, and Scott has to sort of fight back. And this, you know, sort of sets up for the rest of the movie. I mean, we don't know that there are going to be more, but there are. And he sort of fights him in like a sort of Street Fighter sort of, you know, one-on-one arcade game style. But also there's like a little bit of Bollywood influence there as well.
Yeah,
I thought that was, you know, maybe one of the like the few like really cringy scenes in the movie, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like it's interesting in this whole thing. Like, I feel like I can kind of take a little bit more of a pass at the movie for being like, okay, well, is it documentation of sort of like how bad men can be with women in their early 20s, and like the idea of kind of fumbling your way around and using other people to learn about yourself in terms of like that early male relationship stuff, which like feels at once like cringy to my own past, but also kind of deeply relatable to kind of how I was when I was kind of like 19 and 20 and just kind of starting out dating. But yeah, the way that they treat race, like here with the Bollywood stuff, I was like, that's not great. And then, I mean, he treats knives terribly throughout the thing, but there's a lot of like very, which is bad, but there's a lot of like very racialized comments towards like just the fact that she's Chinese throughout that also just like were feel, you know, very sort of Vice 2005, you know, South Park kind of like humor we're seeing there. It was just, oh, it's she's Chinese. That's different. That's a joke, you know, and we can just like there's comments in, like when they're in Sonic Boom together about like what she eats and, you know.
It's, yeah, well, I know a lot of that's straight out of the comic. And I know Brian Lee O'Malley wrote the comic. I think his parents are Chinese immigrants. So, I mean, a lot of that may have been like, you know, things that were directed at him as opposed to the other way around. But like he did like post something about the cast and just like how white it was. He said, you know, he was pretty surprised by just how white the cast was, even though the cast of the comic was basically white. Like he said, you know, he kind of like turned his author surrogate into a white character. So he was like, maybe I whitewashed my own story, but I guess he was, you know, hoping that in adapting it, like they could have gone for something more diverse than it ended up being.
Well, I mean, that also feels very true to the music scene that I was in, you know, around like 2010, around that time, you know, it was just like there, it wasn't very diverse at that point. And I think there was still kind of like, yeah, it was just, there certainly were some, or just that, like, the shows that I weren't at didn't make a point of, like, trying to be more inclusive towards women or towards POC people. So, yeah, it's funny, like, that also kind of feels like, even though that, like, made me cringe really hard, I know that Brian was Asian, but, yeah, I was just like, that also kind of feels true to what that scene was, like, people being kind of shitty towards, like, race issues and like not treating women very well. I was like, oh yeah, you really nailed Toronto, you know, circa 2010.
Yeah. So There are more evil exes. They fight the next one over at Casa Loma, which for those of you who aren't Torontonians is this big fucking castle that we have just at the top of the hill in Toronto. It's fucking amazing. It's a great place for dates. Definitely been on a few there.
What, have you really? But they, wait, hold on. We got to pause the podcast. You took a date to Casa Loma?
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful place. It's, you know, it's magical and wonderful.
I have also taken a date to Casa Loma. That view is one of my favorite spots in the city. And if you sit at the top and you have a bottle of wine in your backpack, it's...
Oh, I thought you meant like you go on like the tour of the house and...
Oh, no. Okay. No, I mean, I've done that too, but I mean, that would be fun, you know.
It wouldn't be that bad.
You go up in the turret and get a bit smoochy.
That's true. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, this is where he fights the next ex, which is, a skater turned movie star, Lucas Lee. We already talked about. He's one of the Chris's. And they have like a big old fight. He eventually sort of tricks him into Tony Hawking down the Casa Loma railing, and which is fatal.
It's the Baldwin steps, we should say. The Baldwin steps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Which I once had to carry a Christmas tree up before I had a car.
I used to have to carry my bike up there when we recorded the podcast at your old place.
That's right, yeah.
What else? Oh, they get asked to open for the Clash of Demon Head at Lee's Palace. So this is a big sort of thing. And it's a big thing because Clash of Demon Head is the band that is fronted by Scott Pilgrim's own ex-girlfriend, who he has a whole bunch of baggage over, and he can't even say her name in the house, though her name seems to change. So, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of names you can't say, I guess. But this is a big deal, and so he goes to do that. But he discovers that the bass player for the Clash of Demon Head is, in fact, another evil ex, and they have to fight it out at Lee's Palace. And they
played by played by one of the Supermen, right? He was
that's
Superman.
Right. Brandon Routh.
Yeah, he's good.
Yeah.
Right?
He is good.
And then it's Brie Larson who's the ex, right?
Yeah. And I'm not a big Metric fan, but I really like that song that she sings in this movie.
It's a great song.
That's another funny, if you'll indulge me in a story for a minute, another funny personal connection to this movie is that character is based on my sister-in-law.
What?
Yeah. In part. I guess it's kind of a weird, funny coincidence that I saw Edgar talked about this in like a Q&A or something. But so my sister-in-law is English and she grew up with Edgar Wright in like a small town in England somewhere. They were like childhood friends. She's in like some of his early movies and stuff. And then he came to Toronto. She moved to Toronto. They didn't see each other for a long time. And he was in Toronto walking around with Brian Lee O'Malley, who wrote the comic. And they were talking about the character of Envy. And he was saying, you know, she's based on two people. She's based on the singer from Metric and the singer from this local band. You wouldn't have heard of them. You don't know them. And he's like, okay. And like literally a few minutes later, my sister-in-law was riding by on her bike and thought, hey, that looks like Edgar, like who she hadn't seen in, you know, years and didn't know he was in Toronto and he didn't know she was in Toronto. And she stopped the bike and they were like, oh my God. And they were, you know, They exchanged numbers and stuff and like couldn't believe they were seeing each other. And then she biked away and, he turned to the guy who wrote the comic. And he was like, yeah, she was the other inspiration for that character because she had a band where she played like synthesizer and was the lead singer.
Wow.
So it's this kind of crazy coincidence that the guy who made this movie grew up with one of the inspirations. What
was the band?
Pony to Look. cool. Remember them? Yeah.
Cool.
So that's another just weird thing, which I was reminded of the other day.
That's, that's neat. Yeah. Well, so they have this, there's another ex-boyfriend battle, and they win, and there's more of that, too. I mean, eventually, it starts to sort of take its toll on the relationship, and also, like, Scott is kind of an ass to Ramona. Like, at one point, they're at an after party, and he's like, "Is there anybody at this party you haven't slept with?" I mean, classic, you know, douchebag behavior. They fight the Katayanagi twins, who, you know, have like the sort of dragon thing. And again, I was like, does it have to be a dragon? Is that just the most obvious thing? Or I don't know.
You know, I thought that scene was good, but the extra work was just so poor. It took me right out of
it. Yeah, it really kind of like took away, you know, brings you out of the mise-en-scene or whatever. It's like, it's not... it's just one guy who won't stop looking directly into the camera.
Yeah.
But it turns out that the whole movie, they've sort of been chasing around this sort of producer guy who will sign their band to the label. And that's why they've been playing all the Battle of the Bands. And that's what they've sort of been working for. And then, of course, it turns out that this guy, G-Man, as they've been calling him, is, in fact, Gideon Graves, the final ex of Ramona Flowers. And once they sort of like meet, Ramona says that, you know, she just can't help herself around him. And she sort of goes back with him and leaves Scott crushed. And Gideon, I mean, he tries to be, you know, pretty smooth about it. He offers the band a record deal, a 3-album contract. But Scott, he's not taking any of that. He refuses and quits the band and goes off on his own. And, you know, he's a big man. I mean, I would, you know, if it was me, I would probably just, you know, get over it. I mean, you know, it's hard to break through, you know. There's a lot of bands with, you know, silly names.
That's, it's also that's, just that, like, the one of the things that also is a eulogy is, like, the concept of selling out is so ridiculous now. Like, right. like I was just the idea that you could make any money off of your art at all, like, at that time period, or be able to make, like, a stable living where you might be able to afford a semi-detached one day, because those, you know, didn't cost $2 million to be able to do your thing based off your poems or your whatever else seemed like still seemed like a possibility at that time. So the idea that like someone wants to give you a record contract and you're like, no, I have integrity. And now it's just like anything. Would anyone please just give me money to be able to make myself.
And Rob, what's that Patreon important. Again?
Patreon.com/rewatchability.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
This is like the final sort of battle, I guess. He goes to the Chaos Theater to confront Gideon and to win back Ramona. And, you know, he's ready to kick some ass. He fights all the bad guys. And then it's like the final battle with Gideon. And he's about to be defeated, but Knives shows up and saves him, only to turn her sword against Ramona. And then they start fighting, and then Scott's fighting Gideon, and it's like all these people with like jealousy issues, just like get over it, man. But Scott, I mean, he has to tell both Ramona and Knives that they were in the picture at the same time, that he had not broken up with Knives while he started dating Ramona, and you know, therefore, he cheated on both of them. And at that moment, Jason Schwartzman Gideon sort of stabs him in the back and he dies. He fucking dies, man.
Wait, can we please stop all this fighting? Nobody stole anybody. Knives, I dated you and then I dated Ramona, okay?
I mean, maybe I forgot to tell Knives right away.
You cheated on me, Scott. You cheated on both of us.
You cheated on me with Knives.
No, I cheated on Knives with you.
Is there a difference?
You weren't wronged, right?
Game over.
But you know, if you remember four scenes ago, you remember that he had a one up that he grabbed. And so he comes back and he gets a second chance to do this. Like, you know, none of us have ever gotten. And he goes in and he sort of like makes more mature decisions this time around. He tells them up front that he was cheating on them and, you know, tries to sort of smooth it over. And then him and Knives team up against Gideon, and they, you know, they use their Dance Dance Revolution moves to sort of kick his ass. And eventually, you know, Scott Pilgrim defeats him, collects the coins, and, you know, it seems like he's sort of won. It seems like he's, you know, won his Ramona, except that she's about to leave. She says, you know, it seems like maybe you two should be together. But then at the last minute, Knives is like, wait, I'm 17. She says, no, you should, you know, you fought for her. You should go with her. And so he does. He gets to be with the woman that he fell instantly in love with. And presumably they live happily ever after. The end.
The end.
Now, here's where I kind of bump up against this movie a little bit in rewatching it. And again, I like this movie a lot. I'm not, you know, this is more like a sort of bigger, more thematic thing. It's like, so I was reading I went back and read some of the books because, like I said, I like the books. And the ending especially is a lot different because...
What happened in the books?
Well, I mean, it's very similar. Like, the sort of first chunk of the movie is a very literal, straight up, faithful adaptation of like the first volume. And then it kind of crams together a lot of what happens in the subsequent books and has to cut out a lot, like whole, you know, the books like really breathe in a way that the movie kind of can't because it's putting so much into it. But I went back and read the final book because do you remember that when they made the movie, that book hadn't come out yet? The book came out like maybe a month before the movie came out. So they weren't working from it in quite the same way. But it's similar in the sense that like he goes to the theater, he goes to confront Gideon, but it's much more like surreal and psychedelic. There's also some reveals, some more insight in that book into like the idea of, a bit more delving into the idea that this kind of video game crazy world is all like a product of Scott's psychosis. You know what I mean?
Oh, wow.
Because there's an early scene where, and also that like these fights, this whole video game mentality is also like literally like it's Arrested Development. And it's also like born out of like, yeah, male insecurity and jealousy and petty emotions. Cause there's one early scene where one of the kind of first action scenes is Scott remembering when his high school girlfriend, who's Kim, the drummer in this, he remembers her. She was like kidnapped by this evil guy who went to a different high school and he had to rescue her. And it was like a big thing. And you're like, oh, okay, this is just a universe where that kind of happens, where these rules exist. And then in that last volume, he's talking to her and she's like, no, that was just the guy I dated after you. And you just attacked him. So I think like they start to reckon with a bit more that this idea of like, you know, fighting your girlfriend's exes, you know, is an exercise in like pettiness and jealousy and insecurity in a way that I don't know if the movie totally does. And I think it's also like the kind of catharsis that comes at the end of the comic is more Ramona's. It's more about her kind of understanding that the Gideon character was this like abusive, toxic guy that kind of poisoned her for subsequent relationships because she was never comfortable in a relationship because this one guy was so shitty and she couldn't quite shake, you know, his presence in the back of her mind. That seems to be what it's more about. It's more about like her battling him in the end. Right. Whereas this seems to be more about like Scott learning to love himself, which I don't know was necessarily his problem in the movie.
Yeah, he seems to love himself just fine.
Yeah, I mean, like, I do think that there was... It didn't go as far as I would have liked it to with it, but like there is some... taking accountability for your own actions, and like that's he gets a different sword in like the second the second battle where he's going back to fight Gideon because he's kind of like owned up to this. And like that I would have loved to like it's funny within the context of this because I feel like in some of Edgar Wright's like other movies there is like a better acknowledgement of like that arrested development that has kind of plagued the characters. Like that happens in Shaun of the Dead and that happens in Hot Fuzz in like different ways.
And The World's End. The World's End is
All about that. Yeah. And so it's funny to kind of see him be able to riff on some of the themes that he had been very successful with, but they never just quite get to that same like level that you were talking about like in the book where it was like, okay, well, if Scott has a better understanding of like a lot of the problems that have been happening are a result of like him acting poorly, then I can feel a little bit better about him being an asshole throughout like the movie. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like that there's a little bit of a step there that like, again, just like this movie feels so personal to me because it just like it's in my neighborhood and I was in it and, you know, is indicative of that time period of Toronto in such a way. But there is something that like I think that hopefully a lot of like that Arrested Development thing from like the angry young men thing is something that you like grow out of and people can tell you off enough so that you're going to start to like change. But yeah, it was very interesting to see like, and shitty to see that like, oh, his self-realization or his like betterment and improvement of self just came at the expense of him being terrible in relationships. And I was just like, I was writing that down and trying to get my thoughts together about this. And I was like, oh no, that feels very relatable too. where I was just like, oh, there's a lot of things in there that are like cringy, but cringy because they feel kind of true. And like, yeah, I just would have loved to be able to see that like kind of next step a little bit more in terms of like him being able to take kind of ownership. And I think that would have framed the whole thing differently. Otherwise, it just kind of seems like very teehee, you know, yeah. About kind of like terrible actions throughout the film.
I think all that stuff felt so true for me that that's why like watching it now being, you know, more than 10 years older than the Scott character, like I wanted the movie to be harsher on him in the end because that's how I feel.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to be right back with more about Scott Pilgrim versus World right after this break.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We're back. It's Rewatchability. We're talking about Scott Pilgrim versus the World. We're here with Graham Isidore, Scott Pilgrim, almost star.
heavily featured in the background.
You know, I was looking for you because I watched the movie after I found out that you were in it, but I couldn't spot you.
Yeah, I also couldn't spot me. I tried really hard to spot me on multiple occasions. No, I'm unseen throughout it, but there's a fellow who looked quite a bit.
Your
like
spirit was felt.
It's true. The vibe of being a shitty 20-something in Toronto. Next Scott Pilgrim, this guy also treats his underage girlfriend terribly. No, it's bad, terrible, awful joke.
Okay, so I have some trivia questions for you guys. These are some really hard ones. Some of them have a little bit of a Canadian flavor, so it's going to be extra tough for our American listeners. So try to keep up. So question number one, the director in the Casa Loma scene is an actual Canadian filmmaker, one of whose films actually influenced Edgar Wright when he made Shaun of the Dead, in fact. It influenced the bleak landscapes. Who is this filmmaker and what is that film?
Is it Adam McGuinn?
No, I mean, that would be the obvious answer.
I believe it's Don McKellar, Adam McGuinn's buddy.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the guy who plays like the Adam McGuinn character in the show Slings and Arrows.
Right. Would the movie be Last Night then?
Yeah, okay. That's correct. Right. Last Night, it's this great Toronto movie, Toronto set movie. And I think it also influences this movie just in the way that it sort of like features Toronto as itself. But it was this great movie starring Sandra Oh and Don McKellar. And I actually went on the Canadian Scream podcast last winter and talked about it. So go check out that if you're interested in what a Canadian movie looks like. But yeah, I found that really interesting. And he's also said, you know, over and over again on Twitter that it's an underrated film. And he screened it, I believe, as part of like an Edgar Wright Film Festival while he was here, maybe at the Royal or something like that.
Rob, before we jump to the next question, I just want to point out during that scene, there's a little Easter egg that I love where they punch Scott through the backdrop of New York when they're filming that thing. Which was just like a chef's kiss moment where it was just like, oh, they're filming a New York scene at Casa Loma. And I'm like, that's great.
Yeah. I mean, that's like a really interesting scene. There's a whole bunch of stuff written about that and the way that it sort of is a metatextual comment upon all the stuff that is filmed in Toronto. I love that scene as well. And I do like that it acknowledges that, you know, Toronto is essentially like, you know, a stand-in for all these other cities. It just, you know, feels good to finally get a little bit of your due and, you know, to see the things that you were joking about, you know, for years be joked about on screen.
I was actually at Casa Loma last Christmas because I went with my son's school for a field trip because they had like Christmas stuff up, but in the basement of Casa Loma, they have framed movie posters for all the movies that were shot there. Just the most eclectic grouping of movies.
Yeah, some of them are really bad, but I feel like this movie raised its profile a little bit. I remember when this movie was being filmed, Casa Loma was sort of like not doing great. Like the organization that was running it was like didn't have any money and they weren't really utilizing it. But now it's, I think they're using it for escape rooms and stuff like that, but they're always doing stuff there now.
Yeah, we filmed a D&D segment for Vice with John Darnielle, the Mountain Goats, where we used Casa Loma as Casa Loma and played a game of Dungeons & Dragons with him there. But yeah, there's the escape room people there who are extremely sweet and very nice, and shout out to them because they gave us that set for free that day. And then there's also a really delicious and opulent steakhouse that's in there too. And if anyone's ever there, the bottom three steps, just as you're going up these steps, if you just go through the left, there's a low part of the fence where you can sneak into the gardens for a very beautiful little date if you're somewhere.
Little Toronto Easter egg for y'all.
There you go.
So I have another trivia question for you guys. So the credit sequence at the beginning uses a variety of experimental animation techniques, including one pioneered by which Scottish-Canadian director of the National Film Board?
What's his name? Yeah, we watched his movies in film school. Is Norman something, right?
Yeah.
Norman McLaren.
Norman McLaren. Yeah.
I was never going to get that, but I'm glad.
That was a tough one. It was a tough one. You really have to know your experimental Canadian film. I mean, also, a great thing to watch if you are ever on mushrooms, because it's just like all these, like, you know, lights and things coming at you and music. It's really great.
So they used footage from his films in the opening sequence?
No, they sort of like did it in the style of that, like when all like the stars are sort of coming up. And that was one of like the reference points that the animators sort of worked from. They also worked from, I think, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill uses some of that stuff. And there are some other movies that do it as well. But I was surprised when I noticed the Norman McLaren thing, or I thought that was like a very keen sort of detail. My third question was, which Toronto band singer is Scott's ex bands based off? But not only did I only know apparently half the answer to that, but we've already discussed it. But I have a bonus level replacement question. This movie is full of video game references and also sort of video game aesthetic. So I was wondering if you guys could name, between the two of you, because this is going to be hard, 10 video game references in Scott Pilgrim.
Oh, wow.
Sure. Mortal Kombat, Zelda, Mario.
Okay.
Three very obvious ones there.
Yeah. Are we kind of like others? The band names? Like Clash of Demon Head and Sex Bob-omb is Mario.
That's one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to tell you a few more?
Sure.
Okay, so the fight scene versus Roxy, who we forgot to mention, but that's played by Mae Whitman, who also played maybe in Arrested Development.
No, she played that... she played Anne.
Oh, shit, yeah. She played Anne in Arrested Development. Her? They were sort of taken shot for shot from the intro to Ninja Gaiden.
Oh, wow.
For the Nintendo.
Okay.
There's also the Final Fantasy II baseline that Michael Cera plays.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The Chaos Theater is a reference to the video game Earthbound, where there's a band that's sort of, you know, kept hostage there, very similar to this. And the pyramid at the Chaos Theater is a reference to Super Mario 3 in the pyramid levels with the angry sun. You guys remember that?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember there being pyramids, but...
There were pyramids. Yeah. There were pyramids. I mean, this game is sort of... I mean, this movie is sort of steeped in the video game, you know, stuff. But I almost felt like one of the things that sort of separated it from, like, our generation, and maybe it's more your generation, because I think you're a couple years younger, Graham, but, like, I think that putting video games as part of your persona was, like, not a thing that, like, you know, people, I think, our age did. But then, like, shortly after, like, you know, it became, like, a huge part of, like, you know, how people express themselves in, like, their clothing.
I don't think, like, the quote-unquote nerd culture kind of that has become so ubiquitous with, like, mainstream culture nowadays wasn't as prevalent at that time. So
yeah.
It's just, like, something that, like, you know, I feel like Final Fantasy is something that most people could kind of reference if they're at some point, or if they had at least heard of that, you know. But nowadays, I feel like that's true. But at the time, that still kind of felt, I think you just had to work a little bit harder for your media, and, like, everything just wasn't, like, on, like, immediately available. So it's interesting to kind of see so many homages to that too, which then just kind of became so much part of the culture.
Yeah. I mean, some stuff about the sort of process of developing this movie. As we talked about, it was filmed before the comic series ended. And in fact, they started developing the movie after the first volume was finished. So his publishers at Oni Press got the idea for making a movie of it, and started talking about it and sending it around. And Edgar Wright received the graphic novel while he was on the press tour for Shaun of the Dead. And, you know, he sort of fell in love with it and started working on it with another guy, Michael Bacall, who is, I don't think, related to Lauren Bacall, but, you know, and, but he was a child actor. I can't remember what he was in, but I think one of them was a Columbo special.
Oh.
It was developed while it was sort of being written. So, like, the movie, as we talked about, closely sort of mirrors the first couple volumes. But, like, the stuff at the Chaos Theater, as you said, JM, it's more sort of abstract and psychedelic. Yeah. It's because Brian Lee O'Malley hadn't actually drawn that part when they started producing the movie. Originally, the movie had a different ending. So, originally, he did not go back to Ramona. In the original movie ending, he stayed with Knives, but
yeah, and then he goes to jail right after that. Right?
yeah. But for some reason, that didn't sit well with with Brian Lee O'Malley, and so they actually filmed the replacement ending only 3 months before it was released. And they had to do it, like, pretty delicately because, you know, they thought maybe the actress who played Knives might feel like she had been, like, slighted or something like that. But I think they said that she was supportive of it.
Yeah, played by Ellen Wong, right? She's a Canadian actress, I believe.
Yeah, right. That's right. And she was actually, when they filmed this, she was, like, apparently 3 years older than Michael Cera. I mean, I can never tell what sort of age Michael Cera is. He's like some sort of ageless homunculus. He just, I don't know what he, his face is weird.
She's really great in this too. I find her.
He is.
Like, I think she's even better than her. Like, he's pretty good in it as well, but, like, I find her character almost like the most fun out of all of them.
She seems to, like, tap into the tone of this movie in a way that I'm not sure all the actors do as successfully. Like, I think she's really great.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some of the actors seem to sort of get the world more than the others. I mean, a lot of them are fun. I mean, I really like Kieran Culkin.
Oh, he's great.
Really funny.
It's funny, you know, I watched the movie and then I went back and read some of the comics, and reading the Wallace lines, it's hard to imagine. It was just hard to not hear in his voice, or like, it was so strange. Like, he just nailed everything about that character so perfectly. I mean, one thing we didn't talk about, like, it is this very 2009, 2010 thing where, like, the movie seemed to kind of pat itself on the back for having a gay character, but he's almost entirely defined by his gayness. He's literally like just introduced as like, this is my cool gay friend. It's like, oh, okay.
But like, that's the strange thing about, like, I feel like the criticisms of like this film from the context of a 2020 perspective are also kind of like, that was quote unquote progressive. Like,
yeah, totally.
In 2010, you know, like even among the, like, I think the patting themselves on the back of that, but like even among the scene where I was just like, yeah, it's my gay friend. I've got a gay friend. Look how great.
Yeah.
Or it was just like, oh, it's my Asian girlfriend. I've got an Asian girlfriend because I don't even see color. Like that type of shit, like, felt very, very indicative of that time period.
Yeah, totally.
For sure. One sort of interesting local connection was the guitar coach for this movie, the person who helped all the actors with their, you know, chops.
Oh, it's the guy from Sloan, right?
Yeah, that's right. Chris Murphy from Sloan, you know, local fixture. You always see him bumming around sort of College Street area.
I met him once. He was super nice.
I met him once at the election. He voted at my stand when I was working the election. And he was kind of a dick about it. Like, he was like, so, what, you got to take my information here or what? Where does this go? Okay. All right.
Yeah,
great band.
I mean, like, it's I think he's disappointed that Sloan didn't become a bigger international sensation as well too. that he has to bum around College Street getting recognized by a-holes like us.
Well, he was nice to me. I was at like a children's birthday party, standing in the corner feeling uncomfortable, and he came up and was like, "Hey man, I'm Chris." I'm like, oh, hey.
Oh,
that was
nice.
The end of it. then he said he had to go vote, so I don't know what else he did that day.
Like, did you know I'm in Sloan?
So we alluded to this at the beginning, but this movie was a ba-bomb. It's
a sex ba-bomb?
Not a sex ba-bomb. No, it was not. It cost $60 million to make, and that's not including, I think, the tax credits that they got from good old Canada.
They got $10 million alone just for hiring Don McKellar.
That's true. It's a Don McKellar tax grant. Gotta keep him working. But it only made $10.5 million the opening weekend, which is devastating.
Wow.
And then after that, it fell drastically. So I think that's what you were talking about when you saw it the week after and it was empty. It did not do well. It just missed the mark entirely. It did go on to make $132 million worldwide, which is double the budget. But I was surprised because, I mean, we're not the only person talking about this movie for its 10-year anniversary. Jam, you wrote a thing for Cracked. There's been like 8 other articles that came out before us because we're recording this a bit later. But I assumed that it was huge.
Well, also, they're doing a theatrical re-release right now to mark the 10-year anniversary, which is crazy considering it was a huge bomb. Like, that's how beloved this movie has become, that they would not only fail miserably in theaters, but then commit to re-releasing it in theaters 10 years later, and then even in the midst of a global pandemic, be like, yeah, let's still release it in theaters. Like, that's how much it's grown in people's estimation, I feel like. I guess
they just had the prints and they're, you know, like, maybe we can finally recoup from this.
I do feel like the casting in this is like, it has got to have something to do with that too.
Yeah.
Like, they did like a read of it, a couple weeks back, and just like
for the Oceans.
Yeah. And it's just like, those people are very, like, there's a lot of legitimate like A-list talent in there, you know, like people who have like gone on to have big careers, even in like the Bit Park stuff, like Anna Kendrick like shows up and
she works at the Second Cup at Spadina.
Yeah, yeah, she's like
the, or not at Spadina, it's a few streets over,
which bothered me because it was the wrong Second Cup, because in the comics it was the one at Bathurst and St. Clair, which isn't there anymore.
Oh, boo-hoo.
There are also, like, a lot of things in the comic, like Toronto locations that don't make the movie, which is understandable. But, like, we talked about Honest Ed's before. Like, you mentioned, Graham, there's a scene in Honest Ed's. There's, like, an incredible scene in Honest Ed's where they have to kind of race through the maze of the store. There's, like, a fight scene in reference library, which is this kind of tiered...
Oh, my God.
...tiered building, almost like the Guggenheim with you know, different levels that was great, too. Like, I feel as great as this movie is and as faithful as it is, I almost feel like the city had untapped potential in a way.
For sure. Yeah, I almost feel like it's definitely like a 20-something version of the city where you're like, yeah, you know, I know Toronto. I hang out in the Annex. I go to the Pizza at Bathurst and Bloor. That's Toronto, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, later, usually after you're like, you know, priced out of the rental market somewhere, you end up exploring other parts of the city, you know, stuff that are north of St. Clair, for example, or out west, say, in Etobicoke. I don't know. You know, it's a big city full of wonder.
This just watching it, I was like, oh, I would love to see like a 6-episode miniseries like version of this. You know, I feel like even kind of keeping some of the same aesthetics, and I think being able to really kind of dig into some of those themes of like what the cost of dudes having to work their shit out is interesting. It's interesting to me too. I think that like I wonder if like some of the failure was like of this film at release was like I think people were tired of Michael Cera too.
Mm. Right. Yeah, he was sort of ubiquitous. Like, he did that movie where he had a mustache, and,
He just the Magnum like, P.I. reboot. Yeah, that was the...
yeah, legitimately, though, I feel like at that time, I felt like he was kind of everywhere. And also, like, I don't feel like this is his legacy as much now, but people really only thought he could do one thing, you know? Which, like, I don't really feel like that's true, but, like, it's... Yeah, between him and Jesse Eisenberg, it was just like, I don't want to see any more people who look like that guy.
Right, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
On my screen, like, during that. And I do think there was a little bit of a blowback kind of from that. I remember at the time, anyways, thinking that. But yeah, it's just interesting to kind of see what kind of got left in, what got taken out for that.
The other thing I sort of wonder is, I mean, we're three Torontonians speaking about this movie, which is beloved by Torontonians. Like, I don't actually know what people who don't live in this city, I don't know what people who are outside the culture actually think of this movie. And I think it is like, it's very much like an insider movie. And it, I think, relies on a lot of its love coming from people sort of recognizing, you know, things that are meaningful to them. Like for Torontonians, the city, for other people, video game things, you know, or comic book references.
Yeah. Or I do feel like the music of that time period too, like even though that this, like this film is really centered around Toronto, I do feel like the indie scene at that point, Canada's indie scene, was batting so far out of its league, like, you know, like Broken Social Scene, Stars, Metric, Arcade Fire, like that was kind of the tail end of like how much those bands like being at the forefront of kind of like what a lot of like popular alt music was. And so, like, I do think that there's, like, a little nostalgia for those things that pop in. But, again, like, those are all Toronto kind of centric or Canada-centric things. So I don't know how much that would play for other people.
Yeah. We should probably talk about the music in this movie. Because this movie is almost, could be considered a musical. Because it's all original music. And there's a lot of different bands giving, you know, full performances in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't talk about the musicians sort of behind the band. Like, Sex Bob-omb's music is all done by Beck from Scientology. Beck.
No, he renounced Scientology.
Oh, yeah, that's right. All right, yeah, I like him again.
Which I kind of feel like the Scott Pilgrim soundtrack is my favorite Beck album of the last 20 years because it sounds like a 90s Beck album.
It's funny. It was like those things have like 12 million plays on Spotify too, like the Sex Bob-omb songs. Like they're really beloved.
They're really good. I really, really like the soundtrack to this movie. Like the original songs written for it. The Sex Bomb songs are great. Like I said, that the Metric song that Brie Larson sings is great. And yeah, Beck also writes that song that Scott sings.
Oh, the Ramona song.
Like that's a good song. Didn't Nigel Godrich do the score?
Yeah, I think so. And he was also, I think, maybe the music supervisor. So I think he probably got a lot of these people involved. Yeah. Didn't get, Johnny Greenwood or Tom York.
Because that's one thing, like, again, comparing it to the comic, which I kind of can't help but do. But, like, that's something that really elevates the movie and makes the movie its own thing is this,
right.
these great songs.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, it's interesting, like, thinking of this in the context of Edgar Wright's work, too, where, like, the Ant-Man movie that he didn't get to make, but that he had written on for so long and had been development, and then Baby Driver later. I feel like there's stuff here that this, like, as much as anything that he did, really informed, like, as a precursor to, like, how to use music in a film that was,
for sure,
you know, all of kind of what he did for Baby Driver.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, well, we should wrap it up. JM, what did you think rewatching it?
You know, I totally wasn't sure going in. Like I said, I had fond memories, but it also, it's funny because it's one of the more recent movies we've done on the podcast, but in a way it feels like one of the most kind of distinctly nostalgic, like that period of time being around that age, the city that we live in being on display, like it feels so potently nostalgic watching it. And also being a guy who played in bands in a lot of the same venues, seen in the...
Did you play at Lee's?
Never played at Lee's. Actually, did I? I can't remember. But Lee's is also like a place where, I mean, it was... We considered booking one of our album releases at Lee's, but it's so, when it's not well attended, it feels so empty, like the way it's laid out.
Right.
Like I remember we had friends in from out of town once who were playing a show, and we were playing another show, and we decided to stop in on the way back, and we went in and they were literally playing to no one in Lee's Falls. Oh. And so I was so glad we stopped in, and I think we bought them drinks and brought them to the stage and just, you know, kind of sat in this empty club, and it was kind of like the fight scene in this movie when it all clears out. But it is universal. Like anyone that, you know, when it's in a band in their early 20s, you know, regardless of what city, can see the similarities or feel very much at home in the story. I don't know, like it's so nostalgic, like almost more than any movie we've done on this show. I do wish that the movie took a more critical eye to Scott's. I think the comic does from what I reread. But also, like, you know, this movie is trying to do a lot that, you know, it obviously can't do everything the comic's doing. And like I said, the comic, you know, this can be a jumping off point for getting into the comic and, you know, having, maybe a longer, richer experience with that. And I also, you know, there are so many comic book movies that try to recreate the style of the book so faithfully that it almost comes at the expense of, like, the movie itself. Like, my first thought is something like Sin City, which is a movie that kind of bends over backwards using digital effects to make itself look like the pages of a comic to the point where, like, you don't really feel invested in it as a story or even as a movie. But this is so unique because it's like, you know, Edgar Wright really made an attempt to make it a faithful recreation of the city and actually like come to all these locations that were so faithfully drawn in the comics and then to faithfully, film them in those actual places, which just kind of makes it an amazing comic book adaptation in a way that I can't think of any other comic book adaptation. I can't think of anyone that's done that or has had the opportunity to do that because all of those places exist in real life and you can just go put your actors there. It's kind of amazing. Or, you know, recreate them like they did in some cases. It's great for that reason. You know, like I said, I've got some nitpicks in terms of the ending. Like, I don't think it quite lands emotionally in the way I think it perhaps could have, but it's a lot of fun, and I had a lot of fun watching it again.
Nice. Yeah, I would say I feel pretty similar. I mean, it is really hard to separate yourself from the nostalgia if you happen to be in Toronto during that part of the time. And I also, like, I do wish that it went a little bit deeper. I think it really sort of loses it because, I mean, you have Scott Pilgrim who's, you know, fighting all of these sort of video game type battles, but they're not like necessarily representative of like the moral conflicts. And they try to sort of like mix them in there, but, you know, the main sort of thrust is just that he's just got to beat the bad guys. And the sort of question of him sort of like facing his own bullshit is like an afterthought. So, I mean, I find that disappointing. I think that like there are like very valid criticisms, like Brian Lee O'Malley's criticism that there aren't enough people of color in this movie. But, I mean, it's really fun. It's absolutely unique. All the characters are really fun. I like pretty much everybody in the movie. So, I mean, it's rewatchable. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really unique and special film. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, it didn't change the world or anything, but it definitely meant a lot to a lot of people here in Toronto. Yeah, I mean, I'll probably just always sort of like think of it as, you know, with like a sort of warmth that I don't think of other movies of that time, just because, you know, it's so familiar to me and, you know, it represents my world. Graham, what about you? I mean, this was big for you. You did the 2 weeks. You almost had the line.
Yeah. I could barely even rewatch it. I was just so devastated by the idea that I'm not Brie Larson or something.
We're all devastated that we're not Brie Larson.
It's true.
It's so hard. But no, it's interesting in that way. I feel like I really love Edgar Wright's work a lot. I think that the, you know, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz have been like important movies to me, in terms of like starting to shape like my sensibility and sense of humor. And this one, I feel like there's a lot of experimentation for like stuff that he would do well later.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the things that I wanted from the film just kind of think like were unfair like for that time period, you know, like I would love to be able to see a little bit more depth with those characters. I would love to be able to see like a little bit more consequences for the actions with Scott, but it's fun throughout. The pacing of it is really good. There's a bunch of good jokes. Like the characters seem to be having like a really good time. Like all the actors seem to be having like a blast kind of performing within it. It's like poppy and it's really stylistically interesting. Yeah. And it's interesting to me in so many ways that like a movie that could have been even more simplistic, like just based on kind of what was happening at that time period and the fact that like comic book movies were getting to be the bigger thing but hadn't quite like reached that level yet, like there could have been kind of like a sort of like American Pie Euro trip cringy version of this that would have been terrible. And instead I thought you got something that like didn't fully live up to my kind of like platonic ideal that I would love it to, but really captured a lot of things very, very well. So totally rewatchable.
It's flawed, but you know,
yeah.
What isn't?
Yeah. And like, I think when we talk about nostalgia all the way through this, it feels like adolescent in a way that's kind of like nice, you know, like I feel like his, like his growing as a filmmaker and like seeing the city grow and those characters grow all feel very, cool. I would love to, like, I was just riffing on like the idea of like checking in on those characters 10 years later, like, just to see where they're at and still trying to struggle through Toronto. Like,
they all live in Hamilton now because Toronto's unaffordable.
They still are in the same basement apartment because they can never move out because they just have a lease there.
Right. Yeah. Which is not an apartment in real life. It's a shed. Because when I walked there the other day, the guy who lives there was taking his garbage out of it.
Yeah.
Did you interview him like as part of the movie?
No, I didn't.
He was like, oh no, another Scott Pilgrim fan. Not again. third one today.
Okay, well, that's rewatchability for this week. You can find us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. Those are all places you can listen to the podcast. If you'd like to contribute monetarily, you can go to patreon.com/rewatchability. You can find us just to gab with us on Twitter or Facebook, or if you want to send us a request for a movie that we cover, you can do that at rewatchability@gmail.com. Graham, where can they find some of your fine work on the internet?
I'm at PressGang on Twitter with one S, PressGang.
Read Graham's articles that he's always writing for Vice. They're always great. Have you had one? There was one recently, wasn't there?
Yeah. I'm working on a couple of bigger things. I had spent 3 months pretending to be an influencer. It's a whole can of worms. I end up getting about $6,000 worth of stuff. It's very good.
No.
So that whole thing, there's a guy who claims that he can make your jaw better as a man by chewing on a piece of plastic, and I've spent like the last couple months with him. So there's all sorts of type of stuff that's coming around. The most recent Vice stuff, the last big piece that I had done, I accidentally turned a person into a porn star.
Yes.
So
that was the one. Always excellent work. And it's always, you know, it's always a joy to see what you're going to be writing about next. Sometimes it's like fun and theatrical. Sometimes it's sort of sleazy.
I never heard it called sleazy before, but I like that.
When Rob calls something sleazy, it's a compliment.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, guys. It's nice to be on a podcast that I actually listen to, and it's always a blast.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for coming on, man. We really appreciate it. And everybody out there, we'll see you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.